Hello and welcome to the Bagel Podcast with me, Hayden Cohen. Before we get into it, if you're listening to any of this with any younger bagelers, you may want to check what's on this episode, as I will be chatting with Miriam Laurie about the Mikveh Project, a ritual bath. Jemima Jarman shows me around the British Jews exhibit at the Jewish Museum in Camden, including one object decidedly not safe for work, and Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers will be sharing the laws of ritual purity in Talmud for Schmerls. I don't think any of these things are controversial, but your kid's your choice. Our Broigus this week is about the climate crisis and what a Jewish response looks like with Laura Balsam from JVS, Michael Lomate from Extinction Rebellion Jews, and Andre Fries from Eco Synagogue. We also have part two of Miriam John's Build a Brunch, where we make summer latkes. As ever, if you're enjoying the bagel, please do share with all your friends, pointing them towards bagelpodcast.com for all the links. If you have a feature idea, that's also the place to get in touch. Right, let's start this off with Talmud for Schmerls with Rabbi Debbie, where we talk ritual purity. Your final warning that we do delve into details.
Talmud for Schmerls.
So for this Talmud for Schmerls, I'm joined by Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers. Debbie, what are we doing today?
Today we are going to make everyone squirm just a little bit, and we're going to talk about menstrual purity.
Great.
Top of your list of exciting things, I'm sure.
I mean, I talk about it all the time.
We have actually had conversations with friends that have led to breakups over whether or not they're going to observe what and how, because my rabbinic thesis was on menstrual purity laws and mikveh and women and what they've done with it through history. So it's a thing I'm very fascinated by, but it's not necessarily the thing to discuss in the first 2 weeks of your relationship, it turns out. So I am fascinated by menstrual purity laws and particularly what women have done with them through the centuries. I'm also fascinated by how we got to the menstrual purity laws as we have them today. So if we look at the Torah in Leviticus 15, there's a really equal, if you like, offering about bodily impurities related to genital emissions. Anyone who doesn't want to talk about menstruation or semen should probably disengage now.
I mean, I think they probably
you
already
can't,
have.
Hayden, sorry.
I think they've probably already. They've already
they're
had
gone.
Their
They're gone.
Bye bye.
So in Leviticus 15, you've got four cases of people. You've got a bloke who has an unhealthy emission of seeds, so or something coming out of his member that shouldn't be coming out, pus or blood or something's not right. Then you have a chap with a healthy emission, which is any ejaculation. Then you've got a healthy woman and an unhealthy woman. All of them are talking about things coming out of the genitals. And there's very clearly an okay emission and a not okay emission. And if it's a not okay emission, you are quarantined for 7 days after you're better. So when you stop emitting whatever it is you're emitting, you're then quarantined for 7 days, you wash and you return to the community. Because frankly, if you're sick, we don't want you to play with everybody else. And we particularly don't want you to play with everyone in the temple. That's where everyone gets together and you're much more likely to spread diseases. We know today that you probably needed slightly more intimate contact than just offering at the temple, but it was public health policy, really. If it was a natural emission, they were very much more conscious that this is fine. This is normal. We're not so worried.
So was this both genders? I thought it was just women.
It is both genders. Ah. I'm so glad you said that, because most people make that assumption.
Right.
And not only is it men and women, but men. So when men ejaculated, they were in the same state that a woman is in when she has her period. A woman who menstruated needed to finish menstruating and was then, but her total time of separation, as it were, is 7 days. That's not after her menstruation, that's including her menstruation. If you were sick, it was 7 days after your menstruation. For a man, if he was having a healthy emission, he would be impure for the rest of that day. And then he would wash and return and be fine. When I first read that, I thought that's really unfair. She's impure for 7 days, he's impure for a day. But actually, a woman would be bleeding for far longer than a man would be ejaculating, I'm assuming, be kind of quite something physiologically. So a woman needs a longer time period. A man would probably have been in this state far more frequently than an Israelite woman who was quite frequently pregnant or breastfeeding or undernourished. But a guy...
Or dead.
Yeah, any of those states. The dead do not need to observe mitzvot, particularly not nidah. And a bloke would be in this state really quite frequently, I imagine. So... if he only had one wife, he would probably enjoy...
only one wife? What do you
right, well, exactly. He probably had multiple wives. He's getting plenty. And this also applies to if you have a wet dream or any other kind of normal ejaculation. So men and women were equally in this state on a regular basis. What happens in the Talmud is we start to see a shift from women observing what we call nida, which is a 7-day total. So the length of your bleed and then a few days after to take you up to 7 days. Moving to what was the application for a sick woman, a woman with some kind of venereal disease, really. So it goes from the time that you cease your bleeding plus 7 days, which is what generally we know of as the laws of nida in modern Judaism. These laws don't really matter after the temple, because the temple is what really monitored these ways of living. If you were in these states, you couldn't offer a sacrifice. When you're not in these states, you can. Once you're not offering a sacrifice, it doesn't really matter. The Talmud needs to ask the question, why is this continuing even without the temple? So this is from Nida 31b, where Rabbi Meir used to say, do you know who Rabbi Meir was married to?
Golda.
Good answer, but Golda doesn't make an appearance in the Talmud. She's a little bit later in Jewish history. Bruria. So Meir was the famous Bruria's husband. She's not the most mentioned woman, actually. Yalta's the most mentioned woman. But Bruria is certainly one of the feistiest and most intelligent women in the Talmud. There's only 7 of them that get a name. But so Bruria's husband, known as Meir, used to say, why did the Torah ordain that a woman should be nida for 7 days? So he's still working in a system where it's a total of 7 days. Because being in constant contact with her, he might develop a loathing towards her. The Torah therefore ordained, let her be unclean for 7 days in order that she shall be beloved by her husband as she was on the day of her marriage. So this isn't anything to do with the temple. What's this to do with?
Marriage.
Right. And how does it help your marriage? According to Rabbi Meir.
So the idea is that if you touch your wife when you can't have sex with her, then you'll get frustrated and irritated. Is that the...
No, not quite. What he's saying is if you can't have tings, you're going to want tings more when you can have them.
Ah, fine. Yeah. I did
okay?
know this. Yeah.
It's kind of the idea of familiarity breeding contempt.
Yeah, I did know this. Yeah.
If you have constant access to each other, and actually what's really interesting in the modern world, psychoanalysts have started to use these kind of methodologies in couples therapy to help keep marriages alive. Of course, they... in the Talmud at this point, we're still looking at a system that is a 7-day total, not impure plus 7 days, which is what tends to be observed today. Although the conservative movement has issued a teshuvah that the biblical nida should be understood as 7 days, and that's what should be observed. But it's a really interesting moment that they've captured here in the Talmud of Meir trying to reimagine, what do these laws really mean to us? Why are we still keeping them when there wasn't a temple? And the disappearance of the temple changes everything Jewishly. And I think this is a beautiful example of how we try post-temple to continually layer meaning on what it means to be Jewish and to live meaningful Jewish lives. So each hug gets its own new layer of meaning post-temple.
Debbie Young-Summer, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
And from the laws of purity to a new project trying to make the experience as nice as possible, I'm joined by the nicest person possible, Miriam Laurie. So I'm joined by Miriam Laurie, who is a community educator, a teacher of newlyweds, of engaged couples, of bat mitzvah students, who is Orthodox. I think it's important to have that as context. And one of the founding members of Partnership Minyanim in the UK, I'd say. Yeah. Welcome, Hayden.
Thanks, Hayden. It's great to be here.
Yeah. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about the mikveh project, which I know you are one of the team members for. I know very little, and I've purposefully not done lots of research other than knowing the idea is to open a mikveh. So as there are non-Jewish listeners, do you just want to condense, if you can, what mikveh means in a couple of sentences?
Sure. So a mikveh is a ritual bath, which sounds a little bit, I don't know, sounds a bit ritualistic, I guess. But what it means is that it's a body of water. It's got to be natural. A certain percentage has got to be natural water. And Jewish belief is that going into this mikveh helps you move from one state of being to another. So you might go into the mikveh, or the most common use in the Orthodox community is women will go after a period, and then after that time of distance from their partner will be reunited with them. But people also go to the mikveh before Yom Kippur, and we can talk about other possible uses for mikveh.
And the one thing that I find really fascinating with the mikveh project is that it's coming from a position of, as in the marketing in the way that I've seen it, is as mikveh as a powerful, spiritual and beautiful thing to do, rather than you are unclean, get clean.
Absolutely. And I should first say that I've never seen it as you are unclean, get clean. And I don't actually think that's there in the sources necessarily. Maybe at some points in Jewish history, there were negative connotations with the idea of having a period and the word nidah. But actually, generally, I think it's a pretty neutral word. It's more a kind of, well, it's a much bigger question, the idea of tumah and tahara, this idea of purity and impurity. But I don't think that it means clean and unclean, certainly in the sense that we mean it today. One of the main impetuses behind creating this new mikveh is to create a space which is welcoming for people to use mikveh as a transition moment and a therapeutic moment. So as part of the center, there'll be four therapy rooms, and mikveh is seen as complementary to that. So just say, for example, you're getting over a bereavement and you want to mark a line in the sand. You might go to the mikveh, create a ceremony and go to this new mikveh project, immerse, and then you might come out and have a massage in one of the therapy rooms and leave feeling refreshed. So mikveh becomes something which is beyond the ritual, and it moves towards the spiritual and the therapeutic, which I think has actually always been there at the heart of Jewish mikveh practice. But back to your question, yes, absolutely, this new mikveh project is all about seeing it as a beautiful spiritual practice. And I think this has actually always been there in Judaism. Mikveh ot used to be everywhere. Excavations have found them all over. In fact, there was one in the city of London that's been, that was dug up, and is you can now see it in the Jewish Museum.
Really?
Yep.
Where was it?
I know it's in the city of London, so within that square mile, not exactly sure where, but Jews have been doing this for ages, and not just women going for that monthly purpose, but Jews have been doing it for spiritual purposes for years. So, for example, it's customary for both a bride and a groom to go before their wedding, marking that moment of leaving oneself behind and the new self coming forwards. Going before Yom Kippur is a perfect example of wiping the slate clean in these beautiful waters. And Hasidim, many Hasidic communities still today, they'll go every week before Shabbat, or in some communities, even every morning.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of effort.
It seems like a lot of effort, but I think it's quite a beautiful, beautiful experience. And people have different relationships with water, but for those who are okay with water, I think we all find the experience of swimming in the sea, swimming in a lake, is kind of a powerful experience.
Right.
And I think something similar is going on with mikveh.
So can I ask, because I'm aware that, don't they say that the first thing you should do in a community is build a mikveh?
That's right.
So why is there a need for the mikveh project? Yeah, especially that in London, where there are already plenty of
mikvah ot,
thank you. Plenty of mikvah ot. Why is there a need?
There are plenty of mikvah ot, and several of them have had really beautiful renovations recently. So we don't have a lack numerically. But I think what this new project is trying to create is a mikvah which has a truly open and welcoming feel, which enables people who visit it to make it their own experience. So what that could mean is that you could create a ceremony around going into the mikveh. You might want to have candles burning. You might want to have a certain piece of music playing. You might want to spend...
Can you do that in existing mikveh ot?
I think it would be seen as a surprising thing to request. At the moment, mikveh ot are generally quite busy, thank goodness. And the mikveh ladies who run them, I think, are largely volunteers. So there's quite a small window of time, particularly if it's after dark in the winter. You know, you're talking about in the summer even, after dark is a very small window of time, and you could have 20, 30 women trying to immerse between the times of 10:30 and midnight. So there's not really the time and the flexibility on one hand, but I think also...
So it has to be the evening?
Traditionally, for after a period of nidah, after a period, yes, it would be the evening. And some people mistakenly actually think that's to do with modesty. The actual reason in the sources is that the Torah says that you're unclean until evening. So the idea is once a Jewish day ends, that's when you can refresh your status, as it were.
That's quite unusual. But it's things like tefillin. There's a prohibition about wearing tefillin in the evening because you're seen as... there's a possibility that you'd be too tired to do it properly.
That's interesting.
That's the interpretation I've heard. And it's just interesting that then mikveh is completely the opposite.
Yeah, I've never heard that you could be too tired to go to the mikveh. And, you know, it can get late and it can fill up an evening, but you can also make it an opportunity for... It can be an experience. It can be some time to yourself. It can feel quite spa-like sometimes. One of my students who was a bride described it as a Zen moment. And as a bride, you can make it into... or a groom, indeed, you can make it into a celebration. And I think this new mikveh would really embrace that. So
how would that work? Because it's quite a private thing to do. Just again, for listeners who may not know, you do go into a mikveh with no clothes on. It's important to know. And so it's not particularly something that, you know, I'd want to do with my mates around. It'd be a bit weird.
Absolutely. And there's a similar mikveh in Boston to the one that we're hoping to create here called Mayim Chayim. Go to the website. It's great.
And it's got rhyming in it. So,
so there we go. And they have very few red lines about how you can use their mikveh to create a meaningful experience. But one of their red lines is you go in on your own. This is about you and your experience and your immersion in the water. So even if you're going before marriage, a bride and a groom, they could go together, they could wait for one another outside, but Mayim Chayim says, sorry, you can't actually go into the water together. So that moment, it's always very private. You can choose to have an attendant.
Is that a halachic thing, or why is that policy there?
I think for them, it's not a halachic thing. I think for them, it's more about this is about an individual spiritual moment. You can bring other people into it. You can choose who your mikveh attendant is. So you could have someone in the room holding your towel up for you when you come out. But actually going into the water is just about that individual experience. But to give another example of why this new mikveh is so needed and called for, not everyone, as you've hinted at, wants to go into a body of water naked with someone else in the room watching them. And in the traditional mikveh ot, there is a mikveh lady, a balaniot, a balanit in Hebrew, who will traditionally wait there, check that you've gone under the water, that the immersion is complete, no hairs floating on the surface, and then shout out, kosher. You're looking surprised. It happens regularly. And for some people, that's fine. For some people, it's comforting to have someone else there. I've met lovely, really wonderful mikveh ladies who shower you with blessings after you come out the water and who just make you feel so welcomed and warm and spiritual. But for some people, having someone else there is very inhibiting for their experience and they would rather go in alone. I had one bride as a student who really wanted to immerse on her own and none of the existing Orthodox mikveh ot would allow for that. And so, unfortunately, I don't think she'll be going back to the mikveh.
Wow.
Whereas this new mikveh project, of course, it'll be absolutely fine to go in on your own.
So what is the purpose of the mikveh lady, religiously?
Halachically speaking, the only purpose is to check that they've gone completely under the water. In reality, I think mikveh ladies today feel, and I think this comes from a very well-meaning place, they feel that they're taking on responsibility for the mitzvah and they want to make sure that the women do it perfectly. And so for them, for some of them, it goes to extremes. They might check your nails. They might ask you questions that you could potentially find intrusive. I've been asked whether I took my eye makeup off properly, and someone and the mikveh lady came very close up into my face and I found it a very uncomfortable experience. I know it was coming from a good place in her, but I think this new mikveh will have a very different outlook where really an attendant, if you want one at all, is there to support your experience and to only make you feel comforted and encouraged.
Right. Well, I must say, I certainly wouldn't need anyone else in the mikveh to check whether my hair was under.
Your hairs.
exactly. And where can people find out more information?
The best place is the Facebook group. If you put into Facebook, the Mikveh Project UK, it will come up and you can read all sorts of great information.
Miriam, Laurie, thank you very, very much.
It's a pleasure.
I love that as a community, we've been around for quite some time and yet we still find room to constantly innovate. Now it's time to whisk you away to the Jewish Museum for their exhibit on British Jews. So I'm here at the Jewish Museum in Camden with the assistant curator, Jemima Jarman, for the Great British Jews exhibition. It's here next to the bookshop.
In the welcome gallery. Yes. First thing you see. I guess I'll start off by saying that this is part of the Great British Jews exhibition. It comes out of a longer project called the Jewish Lives Project. And that's been going on for several years. And the idea was to create six volumes, six kind of reference books, bibliographic entries of Jewish people who've contributed to British society across the main themes that we chose. What we've chosen is things that are really iconic and also just like so much part of British culture. When we think like the Carry On films, there's that sense of humour, fish and chips, national dish, you know, these things that are just like, yeah, that's what it is to be British. But in a light way, we hope that you reflect and think, okay, all these things that I've just taken for granted as being just my culture in a wide sense, British culture, has come from first, second generation immigrant Jewish community. So that's why we think it's important.
So let's look round. So good old Rabbi Blue. Yeah. Can't beat a good of good old bit of Rabbi Blue.
I know, it makes you smile. It does. Looking at it.
Yeah, really does. So you just go around and got Karl Marx, obviously, and
it's like open display, which is unusual for a museum.
Right.
Because normally, you know, things are behind glass or behind a screen and you can't touch them, whereas the whole point of this is that you do go up close and touch things and you pick things up. Like, some of our captions actually on, like, stuck as stickers on the objects, and that was very intentional. We wanted people to, like, just engage with the things and that they're everyday things, parts of our lives, rather than far-removed objects.
Should we do... what is the Jewish links? I'll say the item, okay. And then you tell me how this is linked. Because I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So there is a Harry Potter cubby hole. Is it Daniel Radcliffe?
Yeah, it's Daniel Radcliffe himself.
Tennis.
So that's a dual thing. That's a Slazenger racket, and Ralph Slazenger. Jewish.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Angela Buxton, a Jewish female tennis player, and there are others. So the exhibition comes with a booklet that you can take around with you and also take away with you. And so for things where there isn't writing on the wall, you match up the picture and then you get the extra information here.
There's that very famous Jew, Linda McCartney.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, I know that one's the one that people have been like, what?
Is she actually Jewish?
Yeah, she is. I'm trying to think of her maiden name.
Goldberg.
Yeah, I've got... Let's go for that. Let's just say it was Linda Goldberg.
I did not know that she was Jewish.
I think that's one of the most surprising ones. Hmm. People see that and be like, Linda McCartney? I think someone's even written that in our feedback book. Who knew?
I like that, though. It's like the... We do like the Who's the Jew game.
Yeah.
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 Just below that is Jurex.
One of my favourite objects, just because, again, it's another one where people are like, what has this to do with Jewish culture, or invented by Alfred Jackson? What's his name?
No way.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah. Immigrant from Germany and set up a...
At least his name wasn't Johnson, I suppose.
That's true. And the Jurex, and set up the Jurex brand, was the first condom creator to use latex in Europe, because it was a new thing. It was rubber before then.
Curated beautifully, but if it was me, I would literally just have stuck a condom in the middle and then just had people going, huh?
What?
I suppose kids, though, so you have to be a bit subtle, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's a 1950s condom, and it's got... Can you see if you get closer?
Oh.
So it is there.
This
is showing you
this. I mean, I'm just going to... That does look rather small.
Yeah. So it's there in
It's in like a...
It came in a paper, so more eco-friendly, envelope.
And it kind of looks like what you get individual tea bags in.
It looks exactly like that, a fancy tea.
It's a fancy tea. I probably would put that in some boiling water if I saw that today.
Can't say how it would taste what kind of gone-off lubricant tastes like, but that is a good 50 years out of date. But that was an eBay find. Someone's kept that for a very long time. And it was sad life.
And it's pristine.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, I have to say, putting it all together and going on these hunts to find things.
Jemima Jarman, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming.
Well, that took an unexpected turn. Thanks, Jemima, and everyone at the Jewish Museum. I can confirm there were no dodgy turns after Miri and John's brunch. Here's part two, where John has reappeared and we make summer latkes. Right, so, John, what are you up to?
What I'm up to? Well, I'm making the waffle latkes, or like, what's it, puff? What did we say?
Well, look, it's...
Potato waffles.
It's a Jewish podcast. It's, let's call them summer latkes.
Summer latkes, yes. So these summer latkes, they're actually not latkes, because obviously latkes, you require quite a lot of oil, in fact. Heart-destroying levels of oil. You shred a load of potato. Doesn't really matter what potato it is. Usually, I would say Mary's Piper is the best one to do because it's pretty much a good all-rounder. Then you get a bit of onion. I've used shallots this time because they're quite sweet. and I can be quite poncy in that kind of a response.
It's a very Finchley vegetable.
It's very much. It's a very Finchley. Actually, I'm growing shallots in my garden at the moment. So when we do that episode on like Jewish suburban farmers.
Oh, yeah,
anyway, so what you do is you put those two together, and then unlike also latkes, you have to drain off all the water pretty much. So what I'm actually going to be relying on when I do put it into the waffle maker is the starch that's remaining in it to kind of really keep it binded. Also, you'd put quite a lot of egg and quite a bit of matzo meal. Buying matzo meal, I would suggest.
You mean matzo meal, but oh dear.
Yes, that too. As you hear me being my East London Jew that I am. With this one, I'm not going to obviously put any matzo meal in here. I'm obviously relying on that. And I also put a bit of rosemary, because once again, keeping that Finchley-esque style that we're going to go down. Guardian Mises that we are.
Well, if it was that, there'd be a bit of za'atar in there just for...
So I was actually quite tempted to put a bit of za'atar in there, but then I realised it would taste disgusting. And then obviously one egg. And there was once again with luck, because obviously we put multiple eggs in there. So what's going to happen is I'm going to take this bowl that I've done with all the shredded stuff, and I'm going to take it over to the waffle maker. So here we go. I've put on the spray fry light, no artificial anything, olive oil on there, because obviously you want it to be able to remove it. Then I've got a spoon, which I'm going to go and get from the spoon drawer. And I'm going to scoop the mix. And what you do is you stick it on the... What are you doing?
Don't use your hands.
What
are
you...
Stop using your hands.
Yeah, I'm scooping it up with my whole entire hand and like dumping it on. Because I have asbestos fingers.
Okay, so
what you do is you scoop them all up, and you want to kind of not completely fill it up on like the squares.
It looks quite full.
It's not completely full, because look, if it's completely full, it'll be kind of hitting the edges. So you can, there'll be appropriate photos to see from it. And then you close the lid of the waffle maker, and then you shut it. And I think we put it on for 10 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah, check off the mine.
Yeah, so I'm going to put on my thingy-majiggy, my alarm, for 9 minutes. And I'll come back and check it out after those 9 minutes.
Another good thing about this is that when you're making latkes, you have to be standing there the whole time. It's frying... Kitchen fills up with frying smell, and you're having to like poke them all the time. Whereas this, you just close the lid and you can wander off and leave it.
So I like the frying.
Obviously, latkes are amazing, but it's.
So I think the ultimate comes down to, I think latkes are superior to this.
Yeah.
Like 1,000 times, but
if you don't want a heart attack, this is a close ultimate.
No, this is still nice. This is pretty unhealthy. Let's not like kid ourselves.
It's nice for brunch. It's nice for the novelty value, let's face it, of potato waffles. And it means that the whole house doesn't smell of frying, which is also good.
So we would, if we weren't obviously making shakshuka, we would recommend a poached egg on them.
Yeah.
So you can use them instead of having a muffin, put a bit of like spinach, a poached egg, a little bit of hollandaise sauce. Delightful.
John makes the most amazing hollandaise sauce.
It's my breakfast on my speciality.
That does sound rather nice.
It's so good.
Thanks, John and Mary. More from them next time. Now to round off the show, it's time for the Bagel Broigus. Enjoy. Hello, welcome to the Bagel Broigus. We've got an interesting one today. It's on why do we need a Jewish response to climate change, and what can we do in the community to make an impact? The idea behind this is to explore these ideas and to be pragmatic. So I don't want any showboating. I don't want any climate change is bad. We're accepting at the beginning that climate change is bad. We're accepting that something needs to happen regarding environmental issues. That is a point that we are accepting. If you're listening to this and you don't agree with that, just switch off and come back next time. So today we have Lara Balsam from JVS, and I am refusing to say what JVS stands for which Lara will explain in a minute. You look confused, but I think you know why. Fine. Andre Fries from Eco Synagogue, and Michael Lomate from XR Jews, so Extinction Rebellion Jews. Welcome. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So just think, Lara, as I mentioned you first, JVS.
Thank you. So JVS, also give it its full name
as it was founded in the mid-60s, which was the Jewish Vegetarian Natural Health and Ecological Society. So you can see we set out with quite big ambitions. Today we are a vegan organisation, soon to change our name. We're dedicated to promoting a kind of society without killing animals for food. And there's three obvious benefits to that, one being the planet, one being animals and one being our own health. So primarily we are here to provide advice and information to people who are interested in moving towards veganism, and that's wherever they are on their food journey. So they could be a carnivore, they could be pescatarian, they could be new to this. We're there to offer support and advice.
Great. Andre?
Right, so I'm here representing Eco Synagogue, which is an organisation set up around 18 months ago. It's cross-denominational, so it's supported by the Board of Deputies and all the different denominations within the Jewish community. It is not a new synagogue. We are not an eco synagogue, but we are there to support synagogues and provide them with a practical step-by-step program to enable synagogues and Jewish communities to become more sustainable and to reduce their carbon footprint.
So I'm just going to help, because it's something that took me a couple of minutes to get my head around. It seems like you're investor in people for eco synagogues. In the way that you've got investor in people, which you need to do these various tick box things in order to get that badge on your business, it's something similar for a synagogue where you do this checklist.
Yes, that's right. We have a survey or an eco audit. And there are five different sections in it: land, buildings, community, prayer and teaching, and lifestyle. And you go through those five sections, and there are questions in there that you answer. Things like, so how many does your community drive to synagogue? Do you encourage them to use their bicycles? Do you encourage them to walk? Is your energy supplier a carbon neutral one? So it has things like that that you can work through, and it's not there to trick you or to make it difficult. It's there to say, okay, well, if you haven't got that now, how can you do that? How can you build this into your community along the way?
Great. And Michael from Extinction Rebellion.
It sounds like it's, I have ownership of it, but it's actually more like a bit of an open source group of people who are really keen to raise awareness of what's happening with the climate. You've said that there's a climate emergency. You said people should switch off if they're not interested. Well, I would say, no, they should keep listening. I think one of the three demands that Extinction Rebellion makes, which is, it's like an open source group of people, anybody can join it, and I think anybody should listen to what they've got to say. They have three demands, and the first one is, we're asking the authorities, the government, to tell the truth about climate change. You can't switch off. You need to listen. It is worse than we think it is. It's worse than people expect it to be.
So I'm already going to challenge you. So the reason why I said at the beginning about to switch off wasn't because I didn't think it was important or I was minimising it. It was because at this point, with the evidence, if you don't believe it now, I'm not sure you ever will, because the evidence is so overwhelming, right? So the point I want to get to here is, rather than saying there is this climate emergency, I'm really interested in the nitty-gritty of what someone listening to this podcast can do and why it's a Jewish thing to do it.
Right, okay. So with Extinction Rebellion, they've got these three demands. One is to tell the truth. We need the right sort of information out there. The second one is...
Sorry, I'm being so annoying. By telling the truth, what do you mean?
Tell the truth about how serious it is. People talk about maybe 12 years, 10, 11 years to save the world, to save society. Mm. There are some people who are saying it's even less than that. We're in a really dire situation, but it doesn't have to be like that if we work together. In Extinction Rebellion, there's lots of different, what they call, affinity groups. There's other faith groups. There are people who join groups in their local area. I'm sure there's one in Golders Green or possibly in Hendon.
The other Jewish communities are available.
There's lots of communities. I joined a little group called Extinction Rebellion Jews, and we're trying to reach out to the Jewish community and look at what we can do ourselves to challenge this climate emergency. There's lots of things we could suggest, like make sure that your synagogue, if you're a member of a community, signs up to Eco Synagogues and takes on their rules. Nutrition is a big issue. So we've got JVS here who can tell you about how important it is to do that as an action. And there are lots of other things.
So can I ask, why is it felt that there was a need for a Jewish wing? Why not just be Extinction Rebellion and then point people to go, well, these are the things? Like, why is there a Jewish wing of it?
Well, I suppose we all have different identities, don't we? We have different things that we attach, you know, subcultures of consumption. It's just another grouping that people feel comfortable with. I've felt more comfortable joining the Jewish group because I do more Jewish things. And I also wanted to add something to Extinction Rebellion Jews. I'm really keen on climate justice, so making sure that there's an ethical and political angle to everything we do. And my parents, I'm descended from Ghanaian, so I call myself a Black British person. I'm a British, well, I'm from East Yorkshire. That's what my heritage is. I'm a Yorkshire person.
Good on you. Where all the good people are from.
Yorkshire born in Yorkshire. I have cousins in Africa and in other parts of the world who are some of these people who live on $1 a day, $2 a day, and they're being affected by climate change really severely. So I wanted to ensure that what Extinction Rebellion Jews are doing looks at their voice, listens to the impacts that climate change is having on their lives, make sure that we bring that voice into it. So it's not just a Western European campaign. And another aspect of it was the arrest part. As a black man, I'm not going to give myself to the police. I just don't want to be anywhere near them. I'm not a criminal, but there's a different dynamic. And I wanted to make sure that XI Jews understood that. And they do. They're really great. The group of people who are involved in it, they're just amazing and they understand everything. So I didn't really need to bring that. But we're doing a little bit of work with some other Jewish groups, a Commonwealth Jewish Council, who are reaching out to Jewish communities around the world. They're doing a lot of stuff with small island states. And we're getting the voice of people who are being affected, Jewish communities around the world who have been affected by climate change.
In what ways?
So we had somebody from Grenada. I don't know if you know, Grenada is often known as the Spice Island. Mm. It's the Spice Island because of nutmeg. Oh, yeah. Some of the nutmeg farms already are failing because brackish water's creeping in, because of the effects of climate change. The water levels are creeping up already, so some of them are losing land. So it's an island that's already been affected. If we carry on the trajectory that we're at the moment, the science suggests that water level, sea level will rise, maybe 1, 2, maybe even more metres. Grenada may disappear, and some other small island states may disappear. So there are Jewish communities all across the Caribbean and other parts of the world. Lots of groups in Africa, including Ghana, where my family are from, who are being affected by climate change right now. Tanzania, they're seeing huge amounts of droughts. We've seen in Mozambique recently a big, terrible cyclone, millions of people affected. This brilliant young girl, Greta Thunberg, has spoke a lot about climate and about this emergency. And I've heard her say, the house is burning. We need to put it out. Well, actually, if you talk about the global south, the house has been burning for decades. Mm. Because of these climate impacts. So, firefighting now, we needed to be doing it 30 years ago.
So, I feel like a dog with a bone. So, I get the you know, wanting the government to be intellectually honest about the threat. And so, having the campsites in the middle of London is a good way of getting attention for that. And that makes sense. The other side of it is what? I suppose I'm just trying to get to the nub of the practical. So eco-synagogue.
Okay. All right, so taking a step back, not necessarily a step back, but in terms of what XR Jews does, it at Passover this year, at Pesach, they produced a Seder, an extinction, a climate chaos Seder.
Yeah.
And they took the 10 plagues and they rewrote them as the 10 plagues for climate chaos. And at my synagogue, Kingston Liberal Synagogue, and I hope at other synagogues across the country, because we asked other people to do it, we asked people to put a chili on their Seder plate.
I heard about that.
To mark the planet burning up. And we did the 10, and we talked about the 10 plagues in terms of climate chaos. And there was a prayer as well. So that is what it means to have a Jewish response to climate change, to climate chaos, is to say, okay, these are our festivals. These are our high days and holy days. How do we mark those? How do we bring that teaching? How do we bring that learning into our communities in a way that the Jewish community understands? So, okay so for example, there was a funeral procession in Richmond and from the XR Richmond group. There's been one in Devon. But that's not necessarily going to relate to the Jewish community, a funeral procession that way, because that's not what we do. But putting a chili on the Seder plate, mm-hmm. that brings right. it to us. So that's right. why you need a Jewish response. That's why it needs to be about our lifestyle, the celebrations, the events that we have in our Jewish year.
That's right. And attaching it to all the different values that we have. We're planning, or we're hoping, around Sukkot, which is sort of a harvesty related thing. Food's going to be affected by this climate emergency. Around Tu B'Shavat, we're hoping that most parts of the all of the Jewish community will declare a climate emergency. Tu B'Shavat, it's about trees. Again, it's about nature and, you know, the Jewish values. There's a part of the Torah that tells us about, is it Baal Tashkit, don't destroy trees?
Mm.
We're going to latch it to that. It's a message that we need to be looking after this planet that we've got, because we're in this dire, dire emergency. So there's also another aspect to it, which there's been discussions when I've been in some Extinction Rebellion Jewish groups. We want to have a visual presence so people know that as Jews, we care about the world as well. And we're not hiding away, and we're not just somebody who you can throw anti-Semitic things at. We're there and we care about the world as well. And our values, our Jewish values are really important to us. And that's what we want to bring out. We want to showcase that and show that, yeah, we're working side by side with people. I think eco-synagogues is almost, it does something to faith work, doesn't it, I think?
Yeah, it does. It was started as a sort of offshoot from Eco Church, and when when it was launched back in January 2018, so only 18 months ago, the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury was there to launch it. And yeah, we do try and do sort of interfaith events and try and do cross-cultural. So the main aspect of Eco Synagogue is, as I talked about, is this eco audit, and it allows you to, so synagogues are asked to sign up. Basically, you go through this 5-point program and you answer the different questions, and there are bronze, silver and gold awards. And as yet, so far we've got 6 synagogues who have bronze awards. And we're hoping one soon is going to have silver. But the aim is to try and get all the synagogues across the country to work towards doing that. It's a long, slow process. It takes time. And it takes some synagogues get it more easily than others. The other thing to do is that the big thing we find is you often get an individual or the rabbi or one of the council members is quite keen to take it forward, but they can't do it on their own. You need a group of people. We ask them to set up a green team. So you have 4 or 5 people working on it together, because you need to involve everyone in the community. Part of it is about community outreach, and you should be doing, not should be. We ask you to work with your local community and to go out and do a rewilding project, take over a patch of land, maybe look at doing a bit of guerrilla gardening somewhere, that kind of thing, or help bring in an untended piece of land or do something to bring the ecosystem back. So it is about being involved in your local community as well. So in that, not necessarily interfaith, but certainly it's a way for the Jewish community to reach out from its own possibly narrow confines on occasion.
So Lara, you've been rather quiet there, and I think what I find really interesting actually is that both Eco Synagogue and XR Jews are new in the grand scheme of things. New JVS has been around for a while. What is your plan and strategy now that the tide is going in your favour? No pun intended by tide.
I'll quickly answer the previous question, echoing what Andre and Michael were saying, this question of why Jewish response? And I get asked that almost as often as I get asked, where do you get your protein from? And I think when someone asks me why Jewish, I think, why not? Mm. Where previous climate justice movements have completely failed to capture the hearts and minds of religious groups, whether they be Jewish or Christian or other, we need that link. We need that voice in the Jewish community. And when you've typically got environmental groups meeting up on Friday nights in pubs or hosting rallies or marches on Saturdays, the Jewish community is automatically excluded. And you can see that demand. You can see from the very fact that we have Eco Synagogue, that we have XR Jews, that we have the Sadeh Farm in Kent, that there is a massive appetite for these things. And so yes, JVS has been around since the late 60s, and it's been a lonely journey at some point.
I thought it was longer.
It can feel like longer. And we're really thrilled that there are now a myriad of other organisations doing what we're doing. I should quickly mention the Green Drinks, the networking for Jewish green organisations that we're launching at JVS on the 4th of September. In terms of our strategy, we are committed to mainstreaming veganism in the Jewish community by 2021. As you say...
I've been to plenty of like rabbis for Friday night, and the idea of them going vegan within 2 years. Mm.
So we're not expecting everyone to go vegan. We're expecting veganism to reach the status and the positioning that vegetarianism has reached, whereby it's widely accepted, it's available, and people know what it is and it's easily accessible. So I would love it.
With the eye roll from a rabbi.
Yes, eye roll. Yes. I would love it if... and you started the podcast by saying that the science is unequivocal. We know what we need to do. And it follows from that. We know from Oxford University research, going vegan is the single biggest change that an individual can make. I would love it if
It's not having kids, but you can't say that.
You have to say it. So we're very aware, we're very aware of what's being asked of us, and we each have a personal choice whether we restrict our flying, whether we change our diets. Now, I would love it if everybody went vegan tomorrow. I'd be out of a job, but I'd be very, very happy at the prospect.
You wouldn't be out of a job. You'd still be providing everyone lots of recipes.
That's true. Yeah. Yes, do look at the JVS website for lots of recipes.
I would like to say, by the way, as someone who isn't let's rephrase this, an aspirational vegan, I have used some of the recipes on the website. They are very good.
Thank you. Yes, I think it's not about standing here and shouting at people to go vegan. It's about giving people the information. For years and years as consumers, we've had the truth of how food has arrived at our plate completely hidden from us. And now what we want to do is give people the information and then they can make the decisions. So the next 2 years, in terms of strategy, we're going to be working with institutions, caterers, individuals. We're going to be working with the likes of Limerd, the Board of Deputies.
And the Bagel Podcast.
The Bagel Podcast, it goes without saying. And opening them up to new opportunities. I think what's... One misconception about veganism that I struggle with is people think you're going to be missing out. But every Friday night, I have a trip around the world with a different dish, something completely different. In the 6 years that I've been vegan, I've tried an immense number of new foods, spices, all sorts of new things. And there's a whole world out there to be explored. So we're very much about taking that to people and inviting them to try it out. There was an article in the Jewish Chronicle a couple of months ago, Karen David wrote something, I think the headline was something along the lines of, it's all very well us all going vegan, but what happens to kosher butchers? And I don't think any of us want to see a destruction or dismantling of Jewish culture or kosher butchers, but it's perfectly plausible that we start, I think it was Jonathan Safran Foer who wrote Eating Animals, which has been made into a film, who said, well, we're very hung up on this this diet that we have from the shtetl, this, you know, predominantly Ashkenazi meat-heavy diet. But if we start feeding tofu and the like to the next generation, that will become Jewish food. And I recently read of a butcher up north that started selling vegan products. And I'm waiting to see which butcher in Golders Green or Manchester starts to actually see the demand for vegan food and start to diversify. And, you know, we want a continuation of Jewish culture, but not at the cost of the environment, not at the cost of animal welfare, not at the cost of our health.
That's right. And at the beginning, your question was what can we do? And that's one of the main tenets of actions that we need to be taking, as well as looking at heating in your house, who's supplying the energy, putting different light bulbs in. If you put LED, they use less electricity. Looking at transport. Looking at what sort of transport you use.
Because isn't all that just knackering? Do you know what I mean? I think I am the kind of typical in terms of I want to do better, but sometimes I just want a bit of Toblerone, right? And I accept everything. Do you know what I mean? I accept the brutality of meat processing. I accept the dairy industry is bad now, and I've now brought in more oat milk to my diet, so I have that more. I still do drink milk, and every time I do genuinely feel guilty when I drink milk, but I do try and drink more oat milk. And I think I'm to a certain extent I'm the typical I'm the one that Laura wants to snag, but at a certain point, so if I, you know, I run exams as a day job. That's what I currently do. So it's quite stressful. So I'm running these exams really smoothly. Then I come home and I'm like, on the way home, I'm going, wait, should I be going this way? Or am I actually burning the environment by doing this? Then I go into Tesco's and I'm like, wait, should I be going into Tesco's? And if I'm in Tesco, should I be buying this? Should I be buying that? So how, in terms of the stresses of daily life, and I understand that there is a level of laziness to what I am saying, and I acknowledge that level of laziness, but the majority of us are.
Why I'm involved in Exile Jews and in the wider Jewish community, so I've been involved in Shema, the Jewish Environmental Network, which is a new body that's coming up to try and raise awareness and educate, because as community, we need to be able to gel together. We need to build communities so that we're resilient and so we're linked up. So if, God forbid, there is a breakdown of society, we're not at each other's arms and fighting against each other. We've got a united community where we can defend and look after each other and help each other. Do you know how to grow? Do you know how to cook? I'm pointing to Lara. She knows how to cook.
I'm telling you, in the impending doom, Lara's house is where I'm going, because I know that I'll be well fed if I go there.
But actually, I'll be at the JVS Centre with their garden and vegetables out there.
Yeah. Absolutely,
just planting a bit more. We'll be fine.
And it's about it's about making sure communities are united and that we know each other and we know who's around
to support us. We're not united.
Well,
this is why we're doing what we're doing. This is why we're here.
One of the things that we talk about in the climate change community is talking about we need to protect this for the next generation. Jewish people love their children. I mean, I know it's a cliche, Mediterranean people love them. Jewish people love their children so much. You know, we can't talk about not having children because that's not what the Jewish people do. But
I mean, I did, but...
Yeah. So, you know, that is part of the thing that we need to talk about the next generation. We are doing this for the next generation. Mm. We are doing it for my children. I've got an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old. Their lives are going to be very, very different to mine.
So I think we're going to come to the end. I feel like you got something. I'll give you an opportunity in a second. So if you just want to just go around and just have like final thoughts, which can be a combination of final thoughts and also just I want one tip that a listener can do to do something proactive that will directly help the cause of the environment. I think I've made that as wide as I can. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Go onto the Eco Synagogue website, ecosynagogue.org. It's simple. Sign up, register, and then get a group of people together at your synagogue or community. Talk to your rabbi, talk to your council, anyone. Talk to the head teacher of the Haida. Get that discussion going, then do the survey, and then we'll help you from there.
Okay. I think whatever group that you're involved in, membership, professional body, so you might be the Finchley Actuaries or the Fly Fishers of Swindon, declare a climate emergency. Do that now.
So final thought would be, I want to take the opportunity to pick you up on your comment about laziness, because I think as a community, if we're good at anything, it's facing adversity. So if we take a longer term view, changing your light bulbs, flying a bit less, these are really, really minor inconveniences compared to what's coming. And so whilst it feels incredibly overwhelming, our generation.
LEDs, by the way, LEDs.
I'm very impressed. So whilst it feels incredibly overwhelming to be burdened with this job of fixing things with the clock, counting down, I personally find it quite empowering. So we've got the information at our fingertips. We've got Extinction Rebellion raising the profile. We've got infinite number of Jewish organizations now there ready to provide information. So I did ask you before the podcast if this was going to be a positive one or not, and I'm taking it upon myself to end it in a positive way. And I think in terms of one thing you can do, this Friday night, try vegan Friday night dinner. That's my challenge. And see what happens from there.
I had a vegan Friday night last Friday night.
I'll have another one this Friday. Challenge accepted.
And here as well. Thank you.
Brilliant. Job done.
So, Laura Balsam, Andre Fries, and Michael Lomate, thank you so much for joining me for the Broigus. And I hope I didn't annoy you all too much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. Now start doing something to help the planet. Reduce, reuse, recycle, and replay the Bagel podcast for all your friends. There'll be a little bit of a hiatus until the next episode, but we return in October. Until next time, Bagelers.